This is the Music Therapy Research Podcast, in affiliation with the blog at www.musictherapyresearchblog.com. Hosts of the show are Dr. Blythe Lagasse at Colorado State University and Andrew Knight at University of North Dakota. The purpose of this podcast is to provide some insight to the research that affects the world of music therapy, especially to help our students and current clinicians better understand how evidence-based practice can improve the lives of our clients, patients, and consumers. Today we're taking one particular aspect of the scholarly writing, edition that we did last week, let's just say that, and taking a really in-depth look at it, and it's the results section. So we didn't talk too much about the results section last week, even though we went through the rest of what a scholarly paper would look like, and that's for anybody who's doing journals, who's doing a case study in an undergrad, like a practicum class. But I started it this week, and I didn't really talk to anybody else about this, but I started giving an overview to statistics and how I want, and I sort of pocketed it with the thought of, to my practicum students, all right, you guys are going to start taking data, and here are some examples of data. We watched a video from a session that I did earlier in the day with kids it's called Toddler Language Circle. It's kids with different speech and language delays. And so we watched a little bit of the video, and we sort of figured out how we document things and how we'd go from documentation to data and then to analysis. And by the time we got to analysis, I was about 80 minutes into the class, and I feel like I should have infused them all with IVs or drips of caffeine or something. I definitely should not have started talking about stats that late in the class. Have you ever had that feeling in a stats class?
In a stats class or in one of my own classes?
Both.
Well, I would answer both. You know, I actually really liked stats when I was in college. And just, you know, I like math. It was interesting to me. And then now that I'm on the teaching side of things, I actually was doing a class last week in both my undergrad and my graduate course about analysis of articles and looking at all those numbers and trying to figure out what they mean and how you can tell if the author is being true to what they're finding in the discussion by reading the results. And, you know, I'm sitting there going on, and then I look up and I realize half of my class is probably thinking about dinner and not stats. Mm.
So you need to, gifted professor in both of us would step up at that point and go, and really engage them and have some sort of be able to explain t-tables based on like a t-test based on differential in pizza toppings or something like that. We'd figure out some way to tap into the weakness and make it the strength and make it something they're very involved with, but I didn't. I think I just let it sit there. So let's try to do it a little bit better this time.
Sounds good.
And just what you said, if you're keeping score at home, the broad overview to this podcast will be how to look at stats, part one, and then how to do stats, part two. Something that I'll bring up later, this is statistics and analysis and understanding this. It's a skill to be gained over time. Nobody takes a stats class and gets it. You mentioned liking stats. I think I got stats, and I think it came to me conceptually pretty well, but I also knew that I couldn't finish my course. You know, if it was a December or a January to May course, I knew that I couldn't just walk around and after graduating and do a bunch of these stats tests, number one, and know exactly what I was talking about, much less have a really good design put in place so that the stats mm-hmm. have statistical validity and construct validity to them, which are very important parts of it. That's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is, for the longest time, any time that somebody at any conference I would go to, regional or national, or state, state conferences too, would do something on statistics, I would always go. And so I'll actually talk a little bit about and have people to thank on this. I saw Dr. Russell Hilliard do one on stats. I went to one this last semester with Dr. Deb Burns and Dr. Tony Meadows, two research illuminaries, if I would say so, in our profession, do one about research designs and qualitative versus quantitative at this last conference. And then there's another presentation that I dredged up just looking for some materials for this particular podcast called From Alpha to Z Scores, A Guide for Basic Statistics for Music Therapists. And this was done by Mike Brownell and Claire Getty. Claire Getty has been on the podcast before. And so they gave this a really nice presentation, a great handout that I still have, and I'm looking at it. Now I really get all the stuff because I took a couple more classes and kept developing myself, did more of these stats and research studies. And yet, there it was. It was, you know, 2 hours of my life, and I went through it. And unless I would have looked back on this worksheet, I don't think I would have remembered everything. So it's doing this stuff is a practice makes as close to perfect as you can get, sort of thing. You're never gonna be perfect. Stats are always arguable. They're always in flux, and there are always limitations to what you can do. You said you remembered liking stats classes. You're probably talking about undergrad and then all your graduate levels too. What's like the one thing that's most memorable for you out of any of the stats class that you took? If I could start with that question. And then the second part of the question is, did you always know why you were taking that stats class? Did you always have a good concept of what your purpose was for being there?
You know, I am going to honestly say I do not recall taking one as an undergrad. That doesn't mean that I didn't take one, but I do not recall taking one.
At KU.
In my master's stats class, what I loved about the class that I took at CSU in my grad studies was you took one semester in quantitative analysis, and then you took the next one in qualitative analysis. So there was a really beautiful balance between the different ways that you can look at data and the different types of studies that you could conduct. And at the time, I knew why I was there. I wanted to do a thesis, and I had gone to CSU for the purpose of studying under Dr. Michael Tout and doing a thesis. So, you know, I wanted to be there and I wanted to learn. And that doesn't mean it necessarily always came easy to me. It was a lot of work. In fact, I remember doing more work in those classes than any other classes that I took besides the graduate neuroscience classes. And once you got it, it was like this epiphany of, oh, now I understand it. And then I think the hard thing is when you leave college is retaining that understanding. Because even now I look at studies sometimes or I'm writing my own or proposals, and I have to really consider what am I going to use and what's the best way to go about this. And I want to mention that even many of your professors and really well-known researchers in the field use a statistician. So it's not necessarily that you'll have to learn everything and be able to do everything. A lot of us, including myself, will use outside help to ensure that what we're doing makes sense, to make sure we're doing it correctly, so that when we're publishing, we're putting data out that is correct to our study. What about you, Andrew?
My favorite stats professor was the one who, right before we started talking about three-way ANOVAs and going through every single simple contrast and every single within main effects and within interaction effects, stopped the lecture, made somebody order pizzas and have them delivered to the classroom. So about 35 minutes into his talk about three-way ANOVAs, simple contrasts, and main and interaction effects, when we were all dying mentally, pizzas showed up. That was perfect timing. That's how you have to teach.
I have to remember that.
The most complex possible statistical procedure for a particular course, you time it so that food shows up and that everyone comes back to you. The first one that I had, though, was actually where I first started getting inklings like, maybe I really do want to go ahead with a doctorate because I do want to do more research. And the reason I want to do more research is because statistics really opened up a world for me. It helped me understand things so much better. And it was a class that I had with Dr. David Teachout, who was at University of Minnesota at the time, and he's now at University of North Carolina, Greensboro, which is really a mega hub for music education research in particular. And although he was a music ed guy, he was teaching us as therapy majors and ed majors. And he created an entire course pack that just has statistical tests for parametric and non-parametric, starts you from the very beginning of frequency counts, and in a semester, very methodically and in the best arrangement I've ever seen, takes you all the way through basically, you know, up to about one-way ANOVAs and non-parametric versions of that. And I just thought, well, this is, everything's so logical and sensical. It just worked for me. But there have been many stats classes between that one and the three-way ANOVA example that I'm talking about too. And so I did decide that I wanted to be, I wanted to be in charge of my own thinking in terms of experimental design, that I didn't want to, I agree that we should consult statisticians. I agree, and I do it. And dissertation advisor is a big stats guy, can talk your ear off about the fallacies of type 1 error if you want them to. I didn't want to always have to be within a team and just sort of know the music therapy part of something. I really wanted to know everything I could about experimental design all the way through statistical procedures, be able to stand confidently in front of a poster and explain it to somebody in really basic layman's terms. And now as an educator, I want to be able to explain a lot of these conceptual issues in a lot of different ways, so that whatever way I can explain it to undergraduate students, they can understand why it's so important for them to do statistics, to understand it now. And most of it is this first part that we're talking about, being able to read statistics and understand the results section of articles in the Journal of Music Therapy, for instance.
You know, I'm just curious, Andrew, as you're talking, do you feel like you're getting to that point or have gotten to that point just by further educating yourself? Or was there a magic turning point in your quest for this?
Let me tell you a story, Blythe.
Please do.
What a ridiculous way. Nobody ever needs to start a story by saying, let me tell you a story. Just start talking. We'll assume it's a story from the context. I've never been able to swim in my life. I just swam doggy paddle halfway across the pool when I was growing up and back so I could pass the swim test and get to the deep end so that I could go down the slide and impress any teenage girls that I thought might be looking at my slim frame at the time. However, last October I started swimming for real, like in a class with a teacher who was teaching adults. That guy happened to be a former student of mine, so that's weird to start with. So the teacher becomes a student, very Yoda, right? But I flailed around, and I at some point I just got frustrated about a month in. I'm like, when do I start figuring out how to learn to breathe? I have no idea how to breathe. I feel like I'm going to drown every single time I leave the wall and try to go from this wall to that wall, because my goal is to be in a triathlon, which he must have had to stifle his laughter the first time I told him that that's what I wanted to do with it. Similarly, but now, today, I just had a swim this morning, and I'm just cruising along fine, but it's 4 months later. There was no magic moment. There was no turning point. It's just something that eventually happens. In the same way, somebody could say, why do I have to learn stats now? When is this going to make sense to me? When am I going to have to use it? When's it going to come up? And you don't really know unless you keep on doing it, unless you keep reading it, unless you keep trying to apply it and make calls to people, talk to the OT you're working with as a clinician and put some data together, put an experiment together, something along those lines. I don't really think there is a magic moment, but I think there are times that I go, oh, it's so good to have this. And the one other story that I'd share about that is somebody else who I respect for his research and publication prowess, if nothing else, is Dr. Michael Silverman at University of Minnesota. At the time that I first started going to music therapy conferences, I would always go past Mike's posters, because he was a Florida State University student. The Florida State crew always had a ton of posters up. They basically had like Florida State Row at the poster conference. You could go and see a bunch, and they're all, you know, great and all over the country now teaching at different universities, so it's neat to see how that happened. But he would always have, you know, ANCOVAs and ANOVAs and MENOVAs and all these complex stats, and I go, how did you know how to do this? Where did you learn this? I just didn't see that many people doing this. Or I would ask him, are you using a stats person or whatever? And he said, no, I did it myself, and I took it very seriously. And he really considered himself, you know, a stats geek. And And I thought, that's great. I think that sort of autonomy can really free up what you want to do with people to help them better. I think there's an altruistic sense or altruistic case that you can make that if the better you know statistics and the better you understand research and experimental design, the better you can help any of your clients, whether you're doing a study with them or not, because you better understand research, you can apply it, which is what we always talk about in this podcast, evidence-based practice, at least from a quantitative perspective. So I just wanted to put that out there and say there are stats people in our profession, but there can always be more stats people that better understand what's going on. And I think we're already seeing it in the with Sherry Robb taking over Journal of Music Therapy, because now there's also a statistical editor for that particular journal. Mm-hmm. And I think things are growing from that way. So where do you want to dive in?
Where do I want to dive in?
Yeah.
Well, I think that perhaps...
Because it could be the reading part. If we want to stick with the reading part again, part of reading results and stats is of particular interest to you?
Sure. And I guess the first thing I want to say, and I love what you just said about being able to do stats. And I think it's one of those things when people hear stats, and I'll admit, myself included, you almost get scared right away or get this like wall built up that I can't do that or that's too confusing. It's just time and work to break that down in that learning process. So don't be intimidated by stats. And I want to say that I think it's really important to know what's going on in those results sections so that you can determine, you know, what the authors are saying and what they're trying to conclude based on their results. So I would say let's start with reading overall in a study the stats section.
Mm-hmm. Can I pick the first one?
Sure.
All right. So I'll pick the first one. And we're just talking about the winter 2011 Journal of Music Therapy because and if you really want to just get ideas for studies and how to write things up, then just go to your nearest Journal of Music Therapy or Perspectives or whatever you want to find and find an article that has the effect of at the beginning of it. And there's several of them in this particular issue. So I'm looking at the Lori Gooding article. Lori's at University of Kentucky. The title is The Effect of a Music Therapy Social Skills Training Program on Improving Social Competence in Children and Adolescents with Social Skills Deficits. Now you can go through the rest of the article just like we talked about last week, but if I skip ahead to the results section, results is actually a pretty short section usually in most journal articles. It's usually mm-hmm. just, especially for quantitative things, it's just here are the numbers, but you'll always have the appendices, tables, graphs. It's always good to have some measure, some sort of graph that shows you something that makes things obvious to you. So I'm just looking at one of her tables, and I can read it quickly based on some of my stats experience. So this one's on school results. It says teacher ratings, self ratings, and researcher ratings. And so what she has basically is a means table and a p-value, very basic. And a p-value a p-value is not the same as an alpha level. We should make sure we always discriminate between those two things. Alpha level is somewhat arbitrary. For us in social sciences, we say 0.05 is the alpha level that we're always looking for so that we can say something is significant. And so, Blythe, how do you explain what the alpha level is?
Well, I usually explain it in terms of how much risk you're willing to take for making an error. So, yes, it's an arbitrary number. And in some studies, you'll see, like a medical study, you'll probably see a number like 0.001 is what they're looking for. And it all has to do with the amount of error they're willing to take on. So 0.05, which is what we usually use, is a 5% chance that you're seeing something where there is nothing.
Mm-hmm. And that's a very different, so if you report a p-value that is 0.05 or less than that, that's all we really mean by significance. Now the difference with that is you could have 0.049 as your p-value, or you could have 0.00001 as your p-value, and those two values are very different levels of risk, and you'd probably want to change the way that you reported your results in your discussion section. So you wouldn't go nuts and go, well, clearly I've got the next cure for cancer here because I've got below 0.05 if you're only at 0.049. Very different. So that gets into a more extended discussion about effect size and power and all those sorts of things. But basically, the basic part of the Gooding article is that she did a comparison. She did a basic T-table comparison of here's two groups, and it's about comparing means or averages. And that's one of the areas of central tendency that we would talk about, means, medians, or modes. So those are descriptive statistics, and then there's inferential statistics. The two of them usually end up in the same results section because even if you do have inferential statistics, you want to be able to explain something about demographics or whatever and be able to give some percentages and talk about the gender and is everybody right-handed or left-handed in the study or whatever it is in particular. Let me go through a couple questions and you shoot some back at me then. So the Gooding article, for instance, she's studying something. She's studying teacher report, self-report, all these other things. There's independent variables and dependent variables. Do you have any sort of magic definitions that are really that you've found particularly helpful for those two terms?
Not necessarily magic, but dependent is usually what your client comes in with or the thing that you're going to be measuring the effect of the independent variable on. Mm-hmm. How do you usually explain that?
Yeah, the independent variable is the thing that you're manipulating. So even if you don't want to use the terms IV and DV for those variables, you can say there's the manipulation and then there's the measure. You know, there's the thing that you're going to change and screw around with, and maybe that's treatment type. And then what is the one thing that you're going to try to change? So, and we're talking mainly here, I would say well over 90% of all the articles that I've ever read in JMT or perspectives would be considered, the quantitative ones would be considered univariate statistics in that there's really only one dependent variable that's being measured per statistical test. There are some more elaborate ones, some more elaborate studies. 90% is probably even being conservative. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
Yeah. So when people start talking about stats, I don't think if you feel like you have to be like minor in statistics to be a good researcher, I don't think that's the case. I think you can get to a certain level where you understand a certain number of tests so that conceptually they're all there for you. If conceptually everything's in place, then it's just a matter of you sort of figuring out your design to fit around those different results and things that you want to get to.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked a little bit about descriptive and inferential statistics. There's another way of talking about data, and there's four main areas of data: nominal data, ordinal data, ratio, and interval. So depending on what you're working with, let's talk about a pretty basic study. So let's say you're a clinician and you're working with children with autism and you want to measure some dependent variable, some thing that they come in with. What's a popular thing that you see in autism research that would make for a pretty elementary, basic dependent variable for measurement?
Elementary?
Yeah.
Well, let's go with joint attention.
Joint attention. So joint attention could be considered a dependent variable. And how would you measure joint attention?
Let's say we were measuring a child's... I look at joint attention as a triangle between two people and an object or something. So the baby points at the plane, mom looks up at the plane, and we're both attending jointly to something. So we would look at maybe eye gaze towards something that someone else had initiated. So eye gaze...
Duration?
How would I measure it? I see. Yes, you would usually either do frequency or duration. Typically frequency.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, and either one. So let's say we're doing frequency. Now you're doing a tally count, maybe. And it could be based on a time interval and all that stuff. But either way, this you're coming up with a number of child of that is somewhat emblematic that you and hopefully the rest of the research community that's going to be looking at your paper will agree that this is a dependent variable. This is a good one to look at. This is a good way to measure this particular thing that you're interested in. And why, in, you know, later in the paper, you have to explain, why is joint attention even important? Well, you can think of a lot of ways that it's important, but you have to make that case when mm-hmm. you write these things out, too. Either one of those would be called, well, depending on how you did it, it would be either ratio or interval. So anything mm-hmm. that you see that's usually any sort of number, you know, decimal points, percentages, proportions, those sorts of things, those are in the ratio and interval category. If you want to do something with nominal or ordinal data, now you're talking about something different that we're not really going to go too much into. It's non-parametric statistics, because nominal is something based on names and ordinal is based on ranks of people. So it's not as an exact science in terms of doing statistical tests as using ratio or interval data.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this also goes back to the effects of articles that are in JMT.
Yep, I just want to mention that sometimes you have categorical data that are on a scale, like a Likert-type scale,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of debate as to how that should be handled in statistics. So right. sometimes you'll read that someone used non-parametric for categorical data, and then you'll read sometimes that someone else has used parametric, and that is a point of debate in the literature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So we talked, just to go over a couple of terms, we talked about central tendency, the mean, the median, the mode. The mean is the average, and the median is another measure of central tendency, but it's not as prone to variation as the mean is. For instance, let's say all professors who make podcasts at research universities are making $5 an hour, just throwing out a number arbitrarily. So I don't know what that comes down to. Let's say we're making $1,000 a year, because that's obviously not what we're making, but just for the sake of the argument. So podcasting professors making $1,000 a year, but professors at those particular, or presidents at those particular universities, maybe they've got, maybe they're making something like, I don't know, $1 million a year. But if you're going to put all of those average salaries for everybody at the university together, then the average, the mean, is going to be much higher than the median. The median is only going to be based on where's the middle of every single person in that group, as opposed to I'm going to add the entire group up and then I'm going to average it. Not to say that presidents are paid sometimes exorbitant amount of monies or anything, and sometimes podcasting professors don't make very much at all, but it happens sometimes. It's an interesting example, anyways. Sometimes the one that's always in stats books is like realty or housing markets or whatever, where they're like every house on this block is $25,000, but then there's one house that's $300,000. Well, the mean is still going to be closer to $25,000 than it is to $300,000, but that one is going to throw things off. The mode, no one ever really talks about. It's just the most repeating the most repeating number in a particular frequency distribution. How do you end up talking about variance and error and things like that?
Variance and error. Well, man, you're making me think, Andrew.
Statistics is a fun kind of think sometimes, right?
Is it a fun kind of think right now?
Well, because people will always, I mean, we'll always see the mean scores of something. And I'm sure. Just paging through the Silverman article now. And we'll always see mean scores. And then standard deviation is already always right there. And nobody really looks at it, I think, especially undergrads. I don't think anything that's, you know, 0.765 or whatever. And how do you explain what standard deviation is? What is variance?
Well, standard deviation, you just told us about the mean. And if you look at a bell curve, you're going to have what 60% will fall within a certain parameter. And then you're going to have your outliers or things that fall kind of to the bottom of the bell curve, if you can kind of picture that in your mind. So standard deviation is how far someone or something falls from the mean. And sometimes you can see in studies they'll refer to a Z-score or a standard score, where everyone's kind of put on that bell curve. So the statistics will oftentimes refer to that standard deviation.
And again, going back to the Silverman article, if anybody is listening and you want to see it in action too, page 521 is the Michael Silverman article, and he's comparing three different conditions with a ANOVA, which is a multivariate analysis of variance. And he's got condition A is rockumentary, condition B is verbal therapy, condition C is recreational music therapy. He's got all these Likert scale means, and then right next to it is the SD for standard deviation, so that tells you the variance, and then the N. And he's got a big number of people in his study. He's got 141 total, so he's got 40-ish people in most of his groups. And so he can take, with that amount of people, he can have pretty low standard deviation if there's a sense that what he's measuring is doesn't have a lot of variation in it,
mm-hmm.
Based on the clients that he selected. We don't have to talk about clients or anything, but if you see something less than one, that's usually an indicator that that's a pretty good stand. It's a tight standard deviation. There's not a lot of wiggle room. But standard deviations that are really high, then you as a reader can kind of question it and go, standard deviations are kind of high. That means things, you know, answers were kind of all over the board, or maybe there weren't a lot of people in a study, you know.
Right, and that all over the board is that variance. I don't think I answered that earlier, but just how far spread out the numbers are from one another.
Right. So the big thing that it results in is when you have these means, and the one area that I want to focus on, because I think it's the biggest area for statistical analysis in music therapy articles and for students to take data on, are t-tests, really, or some area of comparing means. So you have a group, you figure out what is the group mean, and you have another group, and what does the group mean, and you need to compare them. And your basic statistic assumption is the hypothesis. Your null hypothesis says there's no difference between the groups. Now, obviously, there's some difference between the groups. Say you've got one group mean, say you've got some scale of 0 to 10. Let's go back to joint attention. Say there's some sort of scale where 10 is really high and 0 is really low, and you've got a group mean, and you look at these, and you look at a group of kids at baseline, and their average is 5, whatever 5 is in joint attention, and their one after 8 weeks of music therapy twice a week for 30 minutes is 8. Well, obviously, there's a difference between 8 and 5, but is that difference statistically significant? So that's where you have this statistic task where you're comparing the means, which includes a comparison of the standard deviation, and it takes a look at how many people are in the study. It takes all that information in and gives you that p-value. And then you take that p-value and you compare it to a critical value and decide which one's higher.
Mm-hmm.
That's the longhand way around it. The shorthand version of this is, you have the alpha level of 0.05, and you're going to get a p-value that comes out of the computer or SPSS or whatever or SAS or whatever you're going to use to crunch these numbers. And if that number is less than 0.05, you've got an interesting story on your hands, because you just said, we thought there'd be a difference. We didn't think the difference would be bigger than due to chance, but there is. So music mm-hmm. therapy did make a difference in this particular case. What I'm describing is a dependent measures t-test, because you're measuring the same people twice and comparing their difference in scores, basically. But something along those lines is a real basic way to conceptualize what the difference is, because you can't just say 8 minus 5 is 3, therefore there's a difference. That's mm-hmm. not taking into account all the other variables.
Exactly. And you might see, you know, if you're looking at the studies in the JMT, you might see ANOVAs, and the ANOVA is kind of taking that a step further and comparing multiple groups within your study. So is there a way you explain overall the difference between t-test and ANOVA?
Nope, because all an ANOVA is a bunch of t-tests. That's what I say. An ANOVA is a way to compare, is a t-test is for two groups, and ANOVA is the same thing for more than two groups, and I try to leave it at that.
Exactly, and something to keep in mind is if you see an author doing a lot of t-tests for a lot of different groups, that's not good, because they have more of a chance of error when they're doing a lot of small t-tests, what they should be using as an ANOVA. Mm-hmm. So if you just know that simple thing, that if they have multiple groups and they should be using something other than a t-test for multiple groups, then you already know something that can help empower you when reading research. Would you agree, Andrew?
I do. And just to prove my own point earlier about Michael Silverman and how good he is with his own statistical research is that that article that I was talking about, he was using a MANOVA, which is a multivariate analysis of variance, which means he has more than one dependent variable. So he did one, what we would call an omnibus test, where he can have all of his numbers, a bunch of different dependent variables, a bunch of different independent variables, plug them all in, get an output on SPSS, and now he's got a story. I want to clarify one other thing. If you find out that you don't have statistics, it doesn't mean that you can't ever publish a paper. It doesn't mean you don't have an interesting thing that you shouldn't submit for a poster session or whatever. It just means you're saying something different. It means this thing, the way that it was organized, didn't have effect. Let's say music therapy sessions didn't find a difference for joint attention in a repeated measures t-test for one group of individuals. Maybe we need to add a control group and compare it that way. Maybe it shouldn't have been a repeated measures in the first time. Maybe you should be having three sessions a week. Maybe there should be different interventions involved. So now we're going back to everything we talked about last week, the methodology and all the ways that you conceptualize the particular design of an experiment or of your data collection if you don't consider it an experiment. Now you need to go back and take a look at it. But just because you don't have a number that says significance at the end of it doesn't mean it shouldn't be published, it shouldn't be talked about. It still tells us something interesting about what you did.
And it can also help to prevent us from constantly studying things that we're not finding significance on, because if people do not publish their non-significant results, then someone won't be able to reference that research and say, oh, wait, they already did this. I need to do this in a different way in order to see, you know, what was going on.
Right. So I would say, again, the highest level, especially for undergraduate music therapy majors, for you to understand things is what's a t-test for dependent measures, what's a t-test for independent measures, where it's comparing two different groups of people, maybe an experimental group who's getting music therapy and looking at joint attention, and then a group that's just doing joint attention and control group. If you wanted to have a third group, then it just becomes an ANOVA. That's really the only difference there. The only other statistical test that I think shows up a lot is correlational tests, which is there, you know, if you remember your slope, which is, you know, y equals ax plus b, if you remember any of that stuff from algebra in high school and all that, correlations are if x happens, can we predict that y is going to happen? Any particular examples come to mind in therapy that are correlational examples?
Well, I did a study a while ago where we looked at internal tempo of different motor tasks, so gait versus finger tapping versus repetitive speech task. And then we used correlations to see, you know, was there a relationship between these? And correlation is not causation. So although there might be a relationship, I can't necessarily say one caused the other, but I can just say that there's a relationship present. And we did not find a correlation between different motor tempos in people, spontaneous motor tempos.
Right. And if you ever see somebody walking around with like a t-shirt or driving in a car with a bumper sticker that says correlation is not causation, the odds are pretty good that the person who wears that shirt or drives that car, that's a predictor variable for that person being a statistician, right?
There's a correlation
between people who wear correlation is not causation shirts and bumper stickers to them being statistics nerds in some case. And
sticker did not cause the nerdism.
It did not cause the nerdism. That's right. We don't even know that the nerdism causes the statistics prowess. In either case, follow that person. Get their name and say, I want to do a study and I want to better understand music therapy and I want you to help me and see if they'll help you along then. So I think that will wrap it up for a real basic stats overview. Any parting shots in terms of or advice for writing up a snazzy results section from you, Blythe?
I think experience is what helps in exposing yourself to educational opportunities to learn these things and thinking you know, exactly what we tell your clients, our clients, you know, you can do this. So do it.
Absolutely. You can do it. And I think the experience that you need, especially starting, is go to the JMT, go to Perspectives, get your AMT membership, get those things shipped to your house. Look at somebody else's results section. Just like I said, do the same thing with the methods section last week. Look at somebody else's methods, see if you can copy it. Look at somebody else's results section and see if you just end up changing the numbers. If it makes sense to you, hopefully it'll make sense to readers of the next or the first manuscript that you'll submit and get your name in the JMT. And then we'll talk about you and how great your statistical prowess is. And then you can thank us later. Because like I said before, we are only making $1,000 a year podcasting professors. All right. Good talking to you. Next week, we delve into the qualitative. So dig back into your memory, into your master's degree, Blythe, and remember that qualitative course you took.
Will do.
I'll do my best to. All right. This has been the Music Therapy Research Podcast. If you have comments on the podcast or the show, please visit www.musictherapyresearchblog.com. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Search for the handles @ablythel and @knighthmtbc.